Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey friends, welcome to the Renaissance English History Podcast. This is the weekly highlight reel of videos that I have put out on YouTube. So in case you don't know, you can go over to YouTube and watch all of my videos. The channel is History and Coffee, and you can just search for my name as well, Heather Tesco, History and Coffee, and you will get it. And you can subscribe there. Thank you to the many people who already subscribe. And then what I've started doing is weekly highlight reels of some of the videos that have gone out on YouTube that would be of interest to the podcast listeners as well. So thanks for listening. And you can also, like I said, go over and join me on YouTube, History and Coffee, and search for Heather. And there I am. So let's get right into it. Today, we are talking about two figures in Tudor England who stood prominently, often mostly at opposing ends. And that would be Anne Boleyn, Henry VIII's second wife, and Eustace Shapwe, the astute Spanish imperial ambassador, major supporter of Catherine of Aragon and her daughter Mary. As Anne's influence soared, paving the way for the Protestant Reformation in England, Shapwe became one of her most vocal critics, documenting his interactions with her and his observations in his diaries and in his detailed dispatches to the Spanish court. So he is one of the major sources that we have about everything that was going on when Anne was queen and in the lead up to her becoming queen. And often his views are very much anti-Anne, but they're still very valuable to get a sense of what was going on. So, of course, the early 16th century, a period of significant political and religious upheaval in England, Henry VIII's desire for a male heir led him down the path of challenging the Catholic Church's authority. In this quest, he sought to annul his marriage to Catherine of Aragon, and he became closer to Anne Boleyn. Anne was an advocate of religious reformation, and she became the symbol of England's shift away from the Catholic Church. Spain was a dominant Catholic power, observed England's internal strife with keen interest, primarily because the marital alliance between Henry and Catherine, who was Spanish, a Spanish princess, the validity and sanctity of the marriage became the crux of diplomatic relations between the two countries, placing Eustace Shapwe right in the eye of the storm. Of course, Catherine was the aunt of Charles V, who was the emperor and ruled Spain. So, you know, it was a very personal relationship, and Shapwe was right there. His role was not just to report the events, but also to champion the cause of Catherine and the legitimacy of her marriage. Shapwe's dispatches are filled with disdain for Anne, reflecting not just his personal view, but often the broader European, especially Catholic, sentiment. He often referred to Anne as just the lady, even when she was queen. He called her the concubine in a deliberate attempt to undermine her status as queen. However, as her influence grew and she was crowned queen, the political landscape shifted dramatically, setting the stage for numerous confrontations and diplomatic dances. Eustace Shapwe assumed the role of Spanish ambassador to the English court, imperial ambassador, actually, to the English court in 1529, Prior to his arrival, the scene in England had already been set with the annulment controversy in full swing. It started around 1527, right? Henry's frustrations with the Pope over the annulment of his marriage to Catherine of Aragon were becoming a diplomatic issue, placing the Spanish ambassador in an unenviable position. Chapuys was not just a passive observer. He was Catherine's staunch supporter and therefore Anne's adversary by proxy. In the complex world of Tudor politics, the ambassador often had to walk a very fine line, maintaining diplomatic decorum and advancing the interests of the Spanish crown, especially given Spain's vested interest in defending Catherine's honor and her daughter Mary's rights. Anne, for her part, was acutely aware of Chapuys' sentiments and his allegiance to Queen Catherine. This knowledge shaped their interactions, with Chapuys avoiding formal acknowledgement of Anne as queen. It finally reached a head in 1536, in the month before Anne's trial and execution, the Easter service incident, where he was pressed to bow to her as queen. He'd avoided having to bow to her for the whole 3 years she was queen. And finally, this Easter service, they set it up and placed her right where he'd be walking and he would have to bow to her, which was an act that Chapuys found deeply distasteful, but necessary for diplomatic reasons. The rich tapestry of Chapuys' correspondence and diaries offers valuable insights into Anne's time as queen. He was writing for the benefit of his imperial superiors, notably Charles V. He often presented Anne in a highly unfavorable light. His account, though marred by his personal biases, are nonetheless a trove of details about Anne and the court dynamics. In a particularly famous dispatch, he described Anne as the concubine, called Catherine the true queen. Such terminology, deliberate and pointed, reflected the Spanish court's refusal to recognize Anne as England's legitimate queen. His letters often echoed his disdain, referring to Anne, like I said, as just the lady, rather than her official titles. Also, his letters brimmed with rumors and court gossip. He documented Anne's miscarriages, linking them to the king's infidelities or alleged deformities in the children that Anne bore, talking about that this was linked to Henry leaving the church. This was a common tactic of the time, utilizing whispered rumors and things that people would just kind of whisper about in the hallway to discredit political opponents. Yet, despite his clear aversion to Anne, he was an astute diplomat. His accounts occasionally betray begrudging respect for her political acumen and her unwavering pursuit of Protestant reforms. It's a reminder that even in the middle of political intrigue and personal animosities, the ambassador recognized Anne's broader significance in the historical landscape. Throughout their shared time at the Tudor court, Anne Boleyn and Eustace Chapuys were involved in a series of events that exacerbated the rift between them, especially given his unwavering allegiance to Catherine and Princess Mary. Like I said, there was the Easter service incident. He was really upset about that. He was not happy. But shortly thereafter, Anne's downfall began, so there wasn't really anything to do. Then also the banishment of Catherine and Mary. He frequently criticized Anne's role in the mistreatment of Catherine and Mary, and he consistently held Anne accountable for the fact that they were ostracized from court and for the hardships that they had to endure, expressing these sentiments in his letters to Charles V. Also, he used Anne's personal tragedies to further his own agenda. Every time she had a miscarriage, he would propagate rumors suggesting that they were divine punishments for her part in Henry's leaving Catherine, which is a pretty horrible thing to do, but also pretty common for the time. So these episodes would, you know, kind of solidify the unfavorable opinion they each had of each other. And he would talk about that difficult relationship in his letters home. But they were both seasoned courtiers who understood the importance of diplomacy. Their interactions, though rarely amicable, were marked by a certain degree of respect for their roles and positions. Chapuys had to be careful. If he pressed too hard against Anne, he would risk jeopardizing his position and potentially sour the relationship between England and Habsburgs. This delicate dance was on full display in that Easter service incident, like I talked, and, you know, in all of the events where they had to be next to each other, court events, holidays, anytime where there was, you know, gatherings, he had to be careful around her. Anne, of course, for her part, was keenly aware of the importance of the European diplomatic scene and the power wielded by ambassadors like Chapuys. She might have been very angry about the way he referred to her as the concubine or the lady, but she knew that directly confronting him or antagonizing him could have very bad implications for her and for England. She maintained careful demeanor in all of her official interactions with him as well. By 1536, her situation at court was becoming precarious. Her inability to produce a male heir, combined with courtly intrigues and the king's waning affection, set the stage for her downfall. Chapuys, in his dispatches, meticulously documented this period, providing invaluable insights. He wasn't a neutral observer, of course, but his records show the tension-filled atmosphere of the Tudor court in the spring of 1536. The relationship between Anne Boleyn and Eustace Chapuys is emblematic of the intricate web of alliances, loyalties, and personal enmities that characterize the Tudor court. Their interactions, marked by personal animosity but dictated by diplomatic decorum, are a window into the nature of courtly politics and the shifting sands of favor and influence. So that's it. Today, we are looking at another Tudor portrait. This time, it's the rainbow portrait of Elizabeth I, which is, of course, filled with symbols and meanings galore. So let's talk about Elizabeth I's rainbow portrait, shall we? This portrait, attributed to Isaac Oliver, or some people also say Marcus Gerhardt the Younger. Either way, it's a half-life-size canvas woven with symbols and meanings, painting Elizabeth not only as a queen, but as an immortal entity, a beacon of prosperity for England. The majesty of Hatfield House today houses this intriguing portrait. Amidst a vast collection of paintings and furniture and tapestries, the rainbow portrait tells a story far beyond its brushstrokes. It isn't just an image, it's a piece of Elizabethan propaganda, a testament to the era's intricate web of ciphers, symbolism, and secret meanings. The purpose of the portrait was to present an ageless and divine Elizabeth. A significant departure from reality, given that the queen, when this was painted around 1600, was close to 70 years old. Yet here she stands, radiant and timeless, defying the grip of age and mortality. The symbolism is undeniable. The rainbow held delicately in her right hand isn't just a marvel of nature. Accompanied by the Latin motto, non sine sole iris, the queen becomes the sun, suggesting that without her, England would lack its golden age of peace and stability. Her attire further dives into the symbolism. There's a mix of English wildflowers and exotic creatures, and it paints a picture of an empire vast and diverse. And the eyes and the ears, they tell the story of a queen who misses nothing, who sees everything, a testament to her omniscience and her spy network.
This could also be an allusion to the numerous rebellions, schemes, and conspiracies that had been quashed or circumvented throughout her life. The jeweled serpent on her sleeve represents Elizabeth's shrewdness and wisdom.
Some people also say that these folds are mouths, that the folds in her dress here are mouths, which also, of course, would allude to her spy network and to the fact that people are speaking to her, she sees everything, and she hears everything. And of course, her crown is rich with pearls. This reiterates the idea of her choice of a life without marriage being dedicated solely to her kingdom.
Elizabeth's hair and ears glistened with precious gems, a testament to her renowned sense of fashion. Records from 1587 show that she possessed a staggering 628 pieces of jewelry, and upon her demise, over 2,000 gowns were noted in her royal collection. Yet, her extravagant attire was not merely a reflection of her flair for fashion. The 16th century was marked by strict dress codes. These laws served as visual markers, delineating social status and fostering order, all the while ensuring unwavering allegiance to the crown. One of the most lasting themes present in Elizabeth's portraits is the subtle yet poignant portrayal of her as the Virgin Queen. This theme is vividly showcased in the rainbow portrait, The pearls adorning her person stand as symbols of purity. The intricately knotted necklace underscores her virginity.
And while Elizabeth's status as the Virgin Queen is emphasized with pearls and the luminosity of her complexion, it's intriguing to consider the challenge that this posed in an age where women were still seen as inferior. Highlighting Elizabeth's femininity was a bold statement. Yet this portrait masterfully creates an image of strength, purity, and unwavering leadership. The Fairy Queen by Edmund Spenser, published in 1590, may have influenced this portrayal. Elizabeth's ethereal aura may have been inspired by this allegorical work celebrating her reign. With every detail in the rainbow portrait, from the fiery orange cloak adorned with the human eyes and ears and potentially mouths, to the jeweled serpent, the narrative is clear. Elizabeth is omnipresent, omniscient, and eternal. It's more than a portrait. It's a proclamation of her enduring legacy, a promise of England's golden age under her rule.
Thanks so much for listening to this week's YouTube highlights. Remember, you can go over and subscribe. History and Coffee, Heather Tesco, you will find me there. And we'll be back again next week with more highlights from what went out on YouTube throughout the week. Thanks so much. Have a great week.
Blow, northern wind, send for baby sweating. Blow, northern wind, blow, blow, blow.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.